Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All right. Welcome, everyone, to Value Investing Live. I'm pleased to present our guest, Matt McLennan. Matt is the head of the Global Value Team and portfolio manager of the Global Value, International Value, U.S. Value, and Gold Strategies for First Eagle. He joined First Eagle in 2008 to lead the Global Value Team. Previously, he spent time with Goldman Sachs Asset Management in London, where he served as co-portfolio manager of Global Equity Partners, a group he co-founded in 2003 that ran focused global equity portfolios for offshore private wealth clients. As always, to those of you out in the audience, please feel free to submit your comments, questions, anything like that in the chat section throughout the presentation, but keep in mind we are going to hold those until we get to the Q&A at the end of things. Without further ado, I'll go ahead and hand things over to Matt, and we can jump into the presentation.
Great. Thank you very much. Good day, and thank you everyone for joining this session. My name is Matthew McLennan. I'm the head of the Global Value Team at First Eagle Investment Management. And I've served in this role since I had the dubious distinction of joining the firm a week before Lehman collapsed back in September of 2008. I think that was a sound stress test if ever there were to be one. Prior to joining First Eagle, I worked at Goldman Sachs for 14 years in London, New York, and Sydney. And as you may be able to tell from my accent, I'm Australian, but what you may not know is that I was born in Papua New Guinea. After nearly 30 years in this business, working on three different continents, I've had the blessing of learning from many mentors in the world of equities, be it public or private equities, fixed income, currencies, and commodities. I joined First Eagle not just to manage the Global Value Fund and the related team, but to have the opportunity to work alongside and to learn from Jean-Marie Evillard, who incepted the fund in 1979. Getting to know Jean-Marie has been one of the great privileges of my investment career. The Global Value Fund is a single investment platform that enables flexible investment in both equities and bonds. We invest not just across the capital structure, but across currencies and hold gold as well. And all of this within the context of a mutual fund. We're extremely long-term, with barely more than 10% annual turnover, implying a near 10-year average holding period for our investments. So while we operate in public equity markets, our time horizon is longer than most private equity. We major in equity investment, that is the long-term ownership of publicly traded stocks, but we have the flexibility to hold cash as deferred purchasing power, to episodically buy corporate or sovereign debt when it is priced for equity-like returns, to selectively hedge currencies and to hold gold as a potential hedge. There is a thread of continuity that links all these investments, and that is the combination of scarcity value we seek in underlying assets and the margin of safety that we seek in price. We believe that the price-sensitive hunt for scarcity value is the essential building block of resilient wealth creation. When we think about the goal of resilience, it has both medium-term and longer-term connotations for us. In the medium term, it means having some cushion against crisis. In the longer term, it means the preservation of purchasing power through the generation of satisfactory real returns. I'm going to share some thoughts with you today about how we make this journey and how we achieve these results. But first, I'd like to give you a touch of history on First Eagle. The history of First Eagle is a pretty rich tapestry. It dates back to over a century ago. The holding company for First Eagle used to be called Arnold and S. Bleischroeder. The business was originally founded as a German commercial bank by the Arnold family back in 1864. After World War I, the company had evolved to something more akin to a merchant bank, not just operating as a lender, but being active in foreign exchange markets and taking stakes in real businesses in industries such as ceramic and brewing. Importantly, a culture of prudence existed. which led the Arnold family to mark all of their positions, not just in local currency terms, but to dollars and implicitly to gold. Given these conservative hard money asset marks, they maintained more prudent capital levels than many of their competitors. This combination of prudent levels of capital and their ownership of what were effectively real assets by their equity stakes in the ceramics and brewing industries helped them survive the hyperinflation of the Weimar Republic. The family's business base had been in Dresden originally, but in the wake of Germany's post-World War I economic collapse, they were able to take over the Bleichroeder family banking business in Berlin, given that it had not been managed as prudently as their holding company. The original Bleichroeder, incidentally, who had founded this business but who had long since passed, had been the astute private banker to Bismarck in the prior century. So this was a storied business. The family's New York business presence commenced in 1937 as the family had to adapt to Hitler's nationalization of German banks. They started their operations in the United States as a broker-dealer and an M&A advisor with a focus on international securities and cross-border transactions. From an investment standpoint, they also partnered with certain investors, including Ben Graham, the legendary father of value investing. In 1967, the family launched their first fund for third-party clients, which was managed by Henry Arnold and George Soros. Yes, the George Soros who later went on to create Quantum. This was the beginning of the firm's asset management business. The broker-dealer business was sold in 2002. And since then, the business has been exclusively focused on asset management. The global fund that I've been a portfolio manager on for the past dozen years was previously run by Jean-Marie Evillard for nearly three decades prior to me. Other reputable investors like Jim Rogers and Harold Levy have worked at First Eagle, and we have senior advisors such as Bruce Greenwald and Tano Santos, who have both led the esteemed value investing program at Columbia University. We've been an investment-centric culture through and through and over the years. Our business remains in private hands, with the share ownership structure split between Blackstone, Corsair, certain of their limited partners, the founding family, and employees. The topic of my discussion today is prudence in a disconnected world. I've chosen to focus on prudence in part because it has been a cornerstone of First Eagle's duration as a business, but also as a timely reminder and a construct for an investment discussion, because markets have not rewarded prudence for some time. Savers with their money on deposit face cash yields near zero and negative in real terms. Concept stocks with speculative valuations and unproven business models have outperformed more mature but cash flow generative businesses at far cheaper valuations. Bond markets have tolerated both fiscal and monetary laxity and no longer offer yields sufficient to create hedge value. Credit spreads are close to decade lows, despite an economy in recession and a pandemic. Business confidence, as proxied by the ISM survey, is at a decade high. Equity market multiples are also at a decade high. In fact, they were only exceeded in the late 1990s dot-com bubble over the past century. IPO activity is at a generational high, and cryptocurrencies are all the rage, while defensive real assets like gold remain close to a decade low relative to the S&P 500. Against such a frothy backdrop, one may ask, why does prudence matter? Unfortunately, the best investment opportunities usually exist in moments of the greatest pessimism, such as early 2009. When confidence is ubiquitous, reality has a tendency to disappoint. The confidence tide that has swept so far up the shoreline can reverse under its own forces and draw back out to sea. One needs to position oneself to survive the tide going out once the wave has already come in. We believe that we are at a cuspy monetary moment globally, where the fiscal and monetary policymaker consensus has shifted to the stance that money supply and government debt are somewhat of an internally generated flexible accounting fiction in our fiat money system. That money supply, and thus fiscal policy, is not externally constrained either by a link to gold nor a tough Volcker-like independent central bank. As a thought experiment, and by contrast, in an alternate reality where policymakers believed that money was in tight external supply by virtue of either a link to gold or a tough central bank, governments, companies, and households would all need to operate with less debt. Because when the economic tide turns bad, conditions become deflationary, and excessive private debt needs to be restructured into equity, whereas excessive public government debt needs to be written down to levels that are sustainable relative to taxes. There is no way out of excess when the money supply is limited. Likewise, trade deficits become quickly deflationary. In a tight money world, there is more near-term cyclicality, but less structural inflation, less structural space for fiscal and trade imbalances, and there is more long-term productivity growth as the role of government is limited by its taxation capability, while harsh cycles remove zombie capacity from industries to make way for creative destruction. Likewise, households receive less state entitlements, so people need to creatively identify ways to add value as entrepreneurs or employees. A tight money world is harsher short term, but more resilient and productive long term. By way of contrast, in the current world of a more flexible money supply, policymakers can create the illusion of less short-term harshness in the business cycle. But this must necessarily be at the price of longer-term resilience and productivity. When I first joined First Eagle back in 2008, the global financial crisis struck. For those of us who experienced it as portfolio managers, it was a dark and foreboding moment in our financial history. In response to this meltdown, governments embarked on large-scale fiscal stimulus, in part funded by quantitative easing and zero interest rate policy. This policy shift represented the breaking of the seal and the wholesale entry into the world of more flexible money. Importantly, fiscal deficits run by the government during this period produced corresponding demand increases and thus cash surpluses in the private sector relative to what they otherwise would have been. Private sector cash flow surpluses enabled companies and households to recapitalize, but at the expense of growing long-term government debt to fund that fiscal stimulus. Policymakers, arguably correctly at the time, had no appetite for a second Great Depression. However, once the medicine was administered, the patient was never fully weaned off it. When various efforts were made to tighten fiscal policy over ensuing years, the economy in question either went into recession, such as the periphery of Europe, or teetered on the brink, such as China and the United States, midway through the past decade. It became implicitly clear that fiscal stimulus was asymmetric in nature. That is, it is easier to administer stimulus than to withdraw it because of its direct impact on corporate and household cash flows. So, even before COVID struck, the world was exiting the last decade with generationally high levels of government debt and large fiscal deficits relative to what should have been more balanced budgets during a time of cyclically low underlying unemployment rates. We transitioned to flexible money and fiscal subsidies to fight the global financial crisis, but we never reverted to more normal discipline, even at the peak of the last cycle. The implication of this is that profits in the private sector were also higher than they otherwise would have been at the peak of the last cycle. And then COVID struck. The lockdowns represented a first-order deflationary shock as economic interaction ground to a halt. Having arguably learned the wrong lesson from the last crisis, policymakers resorted to even larger fiscal deficits and even larger quantitative easing to shield the economic impact of this pathogenic Chernobyl. Generationally large fiscal deficits, which were more akin to wartime stimulus, served to create sufficient demand to both cushion corporate cash flows and rebuild household savings. The recession was shallower and briefer than most feared, despite the tragedy of so many lives lost. This fiscally induced cash flow subsidy, alongside declining real interest rates from massive quantitative easing, led to a sharp reversal in markets to levels that now exceed their pre-COVID levels, even though real damage must have been done. And despite markets soaring to new record levels in a recession, the Fed has said that interest rates will remain at zero for several years, and that it will be willing to let the economy get back to full employment, not just the non-inflationary level of unemployment, before it starts to raise rates. It has been talking explicitly about the objective of letting inflation run hot for a time, as it is now pursuing inflation averaging, not targeting as its regime. And some inflation catch-up is warranted in their minds. What we don't know is how this new policy experimentation will ultimately impact expectations. But it is worth noting that in the fixed income markets, the five-year forward, five-year expected inflation rate is higher today than it was before the COVID shock. So much for a deflationary shock. The Fed is also encouraging more fiscal stimulus, despite what has already been the largest fiscal deficit and the largest level of government debt to GDP in post-war history. With the US Senate tipping to the Democrats in the Georgia runoffs, we are likely to see continued fiscal stimulus. This could initially produce some eye-popping GDP and corporate profit numbers as the stimulus is administered. Again, budget deficits mean private sector cash flow surpluses. But if we stand back and we analyze this pattern, however, I would argue the pivotal development is not just the policy response to crisis, but the wholesale transition from money supply being seen as external to the system and semi-fixed in nature, accreting only at a gradual pace, to one of money supply being an internal preference, thereby more of an accounting fiction, and thus something able to be flexibly created to support the duality of fiscal deficits and private sector recapitalization. Looking at how markets are trading and how business confidence is trending higher, this new policy reality would appear to be seen by economic agents as a free lunch. But there can be no free lunch in economics. This is what I mean by a disconnected world. We've experienced the stimulus rush of a flexible money and large-scale fiscal deficit lunch, but we haven't been served the bill for this lunch yet. I think many believe that this policy cocktail is a free lunch, an elixir of sorts. We'll have to wait and see. Let me share some preliminary thoughts on what I think could be the price tag for this apparent free lunch. Firstly, one obvious cost to all of the stimulus is the growing gap between the attractive rear vision mirror returns that we've experienced as sovereign bond, credit markets, and equity markets all rallied, and what are likely to be the more paltry forward-looking returns we can reasonably expect after this rally. Sovereign bond yields are almost inconceivably low. Credit spreads are tighter than average, as can be seen in the accompanying chart here, looking at the history of credit spreads going back to the early 1990s. We're still in a recessionary environment, yet credit spreads have fully recovered. And these credit spreads sit on top of low sovereign yield curves. Equity valuation multiples are also high. This is a recipe for structurally lower real returns for the market portfolio, be it bonds or equities. At some point, households will have to save more to build a retirement buffer, and this will be a headwind to demand. At some point, fiscal authorities will have to raise taxes and tighten fiscal outlays. This will be a further headwind to demand and will crimp private sector cash flows and household savings, just as households are feeling the need to save more due to low real rates of return. So unless we commit to maintaining double-digit fiscal deficits, we face the prospect of a combination of low yields and low nominal growth as we emerge from the early stages of the V-shaped recovery. Secondly, given this dynamic, it's quite possible that fiscal deficits will be kept larger for longer. As such, the government would take a larger share of the aggregate economy. The increased role of the government is a recipe for lower real productivity growth, not higher productivity growth. To which we need to also consider the slowing rate of growth in the labor market, given aging demographics. Lower productivity growth from a bigger government and lower labor force growth mean lower trend real GDP growth. The coexistence of high equity market price earnings ratios and lower long-term real growth does not augur well for equity market returns on the other side of stimulus. Thirdly, and furthermore, this illusion of macro stability generated by easy money and wide fiscal deficits could ultimately be undone by forces outside policymaker control emanating from global currency markets. One could observe a global evolution into less favorable monetary regimes based on outsized currency moves. How could this happen? Well, in the historical world of more normal interest rates, currency valuations reflected the balance of flows between interest rate carry-driven capital flows on the one hand and trade surplus or deficit-driven real economy flows on the other hand. However, in the current world, where interest rates have essentially gone to zero everywhere, the carry trade is largely gone. So currencies ought to be more sensitive to trade flows and perceptions of policy sustainability. Currency could become the new duration. We could risk disinflationary stagnation in strong currency trade surplus regions. Think of the EU or China starting to look more like Japan did over the last 20 years. And we could see potential stagflation in weak currency trade deficit regions that no longer offer the rate carry to sustain their currencies, thereby importing inflation through a weaker currency. Think of recent extreme examples like Argentina and Turkey, or developed market stagflationary episodes like the UK and the US in the 1970s. This too could be bad for equity multiples, which tend to suffer in either deflation or stagflation. Potential equity market vulnerability to either stagflation or deflation emanating from seismic shifts in currency markets is arguably pronounced, considering that equity market multiples have more than doubled relative to the trailing high watermark peak level of earnings over the past decade as we entered this euphoric rush phase of money being a flexible fiction. You can see just how extended equity valuations are on the attached chart. This is a chart of the S&P 500 going back to 1960. It plots the level of the S&P 500 relative to the trailing peak level of earnings. You can see over the 60-year period of history that the average multiple in the market has been around 15 times. This is just north of a 6% earnings yield if you invert that multiple. That kind of an earnings yield makes sense to us because, after all, investing in businesses has its risks. You have the risks of being a forced seller in a 20 or 30% downside correction once a decade. That requires a few points a year of risk premium. You have the risk of business model fade. The current class of companies in the S&P 500 will not have a monopoly on future profits, and you may need another point or two a year to compensate you for that risk. And you have the risk of management dilution, agency risk. Most management teams are not value creative, and you might need another point or two of compensation for that risk. If you add it all up, the 6% earnings yield on markets is essentially shortfall risk compensation relative to the growth in the nominal economy through either business cycle risk, business model fade risk, or agency risk. And we can see today that the valuation of the S&P 500 at around 25 times trailing peak earnings is higher than at any point in the last 60 years or the last century, for example, other than the very peak of the market in the dot-com boom in 1999. A key point that I'd like to get across is that in the rear vision mirror, just owning equity market beta or fixed income duration exposure, just owning the market portfolio, as it were, was enough to generate sound real returns because of valuation expansion, because everything rallied as we transitioned to easy money. But prospectively, the outlook for real returns is much more modest and it won't be enough to just take market exposure. In fact, cheap beta or duration via index funds may prove to be an expensive mistake in coming years. At First Eagle, we believe that the prospective path to resilient wealth creation and sound real returns rests on four pillars, as you can see in the accompanying chart. The first and most important of which is the selective participation in equities, those equities that embody scarcity value with a margin of safety and price. And then secondly, the use of only modest amounts of countercyclical cash for its option value as deferred purchasing power in windows of negative market or industry sentiment, rather than the traditional 60-40 larger, more strategic commitment to cash and bonds, given their repressed real returns. The third pillar for First Eagle is the use of gold as a potential hedge, given it is a store of value that cannot be diluted. And then finally, we selectively use currency hedging and currency diversification to protect real returns. In the limited time that I have remaining, I'd like to zero in on two key components of our approach to stock selection in this disconnected world and our choice of gold as a potential hedge. A margin of safety approach to investing is not deep value nor simply statistical value by nature. You see, if you start with price alone, you end up with the business whether you want it or not. Deep or statistical value often leads one to adverse selection risk in the underlying businesses. One can end up with companies that are busted flushes and turnaround stories. An impaired business is often little more than an out-of-the-money option on recovery. Rather, at First Eagle, we invert the process, and we think first as long-term business owners, which means that we focus first on scarcity value of incumbent assets and market position. Only when we find the right assets are we then sensitive to price and management behavior. While we give a common sense nod to the latent and more measured growth potential inherent in incumbent asset or market position, we do not get carried away in concept stocks that need to create entirely new markets and which are little more than expensive call options on the future. We will typically only pay for value creation we have line of sight to today. In short, we are cash flow investors, not option speculators. As value investors and as business owners, we do start with the margin, cash flow, and balance sheet evolution of a company to first assess the character of a business. But we recognize there are important assets such as market position and management acumen that aren't well represented by GAAP accounting. Such off-balance sheet assets are key drivers of future cash flows and longer-term trading patterns for equities. A key off-balance sheet asset that we seek out is business scarcity value, by which we mean the identification of a business or businesses that have either incumbent ownership of locationally advantaged long-duration hard assets or that benefit from entrenched market share advantage in niche industries. And you can see this visually depicted in the accompanying chart. When we talk about a company being an incumbent owner of advantaged hard assets, we're talking about CBD real estate that's hard to replicate, long-duration natural resources that are well-positioned on a cost curve, or other assets that are physically hard to replicate. On the other side of the spectrum, when we talk about scarce intangible assets, we're talking about companies that possess unique scale, brand, and other R&D advantages that are very difficult for smaller competitors to replicate. Whether a company is the incumbent owner of advantaged hard assets or the leading market share player in a niche industry, such businesses are inherently more resilient and persistent due to their superior margins and cash-generating capacity, which cushion down cycles and provide for latent business potential. What I mean by latent business potential is that such companies tend to have earnings power that grows at a measured pace over time with nominal economic activity, the rising monetary tide, as management can avail themselves of concentric brownfield reinvestment opportunities around their incumbent assets or entrenched market position, thus preserving purchasing power in real terms. To make this more concrete, an example of an advantage real estate owner in our portfolio would be a company such as the Japanese business Mitsubishi Estate, which owns prime CBD real estate, particularly in Tokyo, where it holds roughly 30% of the square footage in Japan's most prime commercial office market, which is referred to as the Marunouchi. For those of you who have visited Tokyo, you'll surely have made a trip to the Marunouchi. For those of you who haven't, it is a thin sliver of land between Tokyo Station, the busiest train station in Japan, and the Imperial Palace. This thin strip of land achieves the highest office rents in Japan. It would be virtually impossible to recreate this square footage, and private market valuations well exceed where the stock trades today. The company has latent potential to grow its plot ratio through refurbing and adding floors to its existing building over time at a measured pace. Another real asset example would be an advantage resource holder such as Exxon, which has hard to replicate upstream oil and gas basins. These scale basins are well positioned on the energy cost curve with longer duration and brownfield reinvestment optionality. They also have even harder to replicate midstream, downstream chemical and refining capacity with both scale and complexity advantages, letting them extract the most value per molecule. Companies such as these incumbent owners of hard real assets represent an important yet more cyclical part of our portfolio. The cyclicality of such businesses means that they tend to remain a minority of the portfolio, whereas the majority of our portfolio is comprised of companies that have valuable intangible assets, primarily strength of market share position. Think of companies such as Oracle, which has over half the high-end relational database market, or Colgate, with nearly half the world toothpaste market. Companies with such strong market share advantages tend to be very cash flow generative and less sensitive to the business cycle than hard asset owners. Oracle can grow in concentric circles by rolling out its new AI-powered database and offering ERP applications over the cloud that link to this database. But the key is that we have invested in Oracle at unlevered free cash flow yields of close to 6%. They don't have to grow that quickly for us to get a sound real return. Colgate can also grow in concentric circles as nearly half of its revenues are in emerging markets where most people brush their teeth less than once a day. There's a slow-moving penetration opportunity, then an incremental premiumization opportunity as toothpaste users migrate over time to toothpaste with specialty ingredients at premium prices. Companies with scarce intangible assets, such as market share scale, tend to grind it out over time. The second off-balance sheet asset that we focus on is our strong preference to align ourselves with managers who behave as owners. We favor family and founder shareholders or strong cultures of equity ownership. We seek management teams who protect their core competitive advantage and expand prudently in concentric circles around that core. We like managers who don't push the capital structure to its limit, who pay healthy dividends, and who are willing to deploy capital countercyclically, be it with CapEx, M&A, or repurchases. Once we've identified the character of a business, looking at its history alongside the scarcity value of both its intangible and tangible assets, we then shift our attention to whether the price is sufficiently modest to provide a margin of safety. We like it when the company's enterprise value is at a discount to private market M&A multiples, and when the sustainable unlevered free cash flow yield is close to or even above the real cost of capital, so we're getting business latency for a modest price. We will bend a little on the sustainable free cash flow yield if we have a direct line of sight to near double-digit returns between the free cash flow yield today and the rate of value creation today. But in short, we are common sense cash flow investors, and we like to feel we are the liquidity provider at a time of market uncertainty or business neglect, rather than just chasing glamour stocks or speculating on busted flushes. What is critical is that we value selectivity. We say no to more than 90% of businesses because they don't embody sufficient scarcity value relative to their valuation. We try to sculpt a more resilient core than the broader equity market by chipping away at pockets of business and valuation vulnerability. And you can see that represented visually here. amongst the universe of global equities, the minority embody business persistence and scarcity value, and the minority of that minority are available at a reasonable price, thus our selective participation in markets. Now, because we're primarily a patient owner of businesses, going back to our near decade average holding period, and some of which are cyclical in nature, and because we don't like to hold excessive cash balances, we want a potential hedge that can also serve as a longer-term counter-cyclical store of value in our portfolios. The low yields on sovereign bonds and the high cost of put options means that we've had a preference for owning a real asset as a potential hedge. Gold is unique amongst the universe of real assets because it is inherently scarce. There is less than 1 ounce of gold per capita globally. Like the businesses that we target, scarcity is critical. And because of its scarcity, gold has served as a store of value. It has no yield, but neither does it have the business fade risk, the business cycle risk, nor the management dilution risk that equities have. Despite its absence of yield, it has produced sound long-term returns from price appreciation, as its scarcity and its stable per capita supply has led its capital value to keep pace with nominal growth. We view gold as being akin to scarce, undeveloped land, which is not cash flowing today, but which holds value for tomorrow. We're not gold bugs. We recognize gold is not legal tender today, but it is a perpetual option on being a stable monetary reserve. That option value naturally accretes directly with the level of money supply and inversely with the quality of man-made money. As you can see in the accompanying chart, we provide you 50 years of history here. In the white line, you see US money supply growing until recently at a compound annual growth rate of about 6% per year, until money supply had a step function of growth last year, growing by 25% in the year ending November. The green line that sits below that is the cumulative return on T-bills. You can see that until about 2000, the dot-com bubble, the cumulative rate of return of T-bills was pretty close to the rate of money supply growth. So the yield you got compensated you for the rate of monetary dilution. But since 2000, and since the global financial crisis, we've seen a yawning gap between interest rates and money supply growth. And as you can see, over the past 50 years, gold has outperformed both nominal growth, as proxied by US money supply growth, and sovereign paper yields. It has done so as gold supply growth has been less than money supply growth. And moreover, as real rates on sovereign paper have structurally gone down and the quality of sovereign debt has eroded. The secular erosion of the quality of sovereign paper is common sense. Once we removed the constraints of an external link to gold for money, monetary creation became more internally linked to the perceived and surprisingly recurring need for policy accommodation. The cumulative yield on cash is less than money supply growth. Paper money is being diluted. Gold is more volatile than cash, but a better long-term store of value. Furthermore, gold is chemically inert. So unlike commercial land or commodities, its price is not primarily dependent on the health of the economy. In fact, you can see on this accompanying chart that plots the real price of gold against real interest rates, that as real interest rates go down, be it in a deflationary or inflationary moment, gold tends to appreciate in real terms, thus adding to its hedge character. The movements in the gold price are not that mysterious at all. It operates like a hedge, but its capital value over time has preserved itself in real terms. On this chart that follows, you can also see the price of gold plotted relative to the MSCI World Index. It would look similar relative to the S&P 500. What you can see over the last 50 years or so is that gold has preserved its value relative to the MSCI World. It has been a store of value like equities. But what's important from a portfolio construction standpoint is that gold has tended to have its valuation peaks relative to risk assets when risk assets were depressed, such as after the oil shocks in the mid-70s and early 80s, or in the wake of the global financial crisis in 2009 and 11. Likewise, gold tends to be more depressed when risk appetite and equity valuations are high, such as the late 60s, the late 90s, or now in the post-COVID stimulus boom. Because we're strategic owners of business in a world that's replete with valuation, leverage, and geopolitical imbalances, and because gold has generated superior long-term returns to cash, we have a more strategic commitment to gold. We own less gold than equities, but we need to own enough to provide a material potential hedge. Think of it like a bank, think of its tier one capital. Gold bullion and gold miners comprise about 15% of our portfolios today. You would probably only see us exit our gold position in a truly bad state of the world, where we had already invested our cash and sold wonderful businesses at highly discounted prices. Think of a depression or a great recession as opposed to an ordinary recession. We do, however, countercyclically adjust our gold holdings so they don't become outsized nor undersized. And while gold has recovered to close to its 2011 highs and in fact set a new high last year, since 2011, US money supply has roughly doubled, and along with that, so too have risk assets. So gold's valuation remains modest relative to risk assets, thus its potential hedge value to us in a moment of systemic confidence decline. So let me summarize. Prudence seems an anachronistic construct today in a world of Bitcoin and Tesla, but the long history of First Eagle teaches us the importance of prudence. Today's monetary world has become disconnected from any kind of anchor. We're living with the buzz of stimulus, but never forget there is no free lunch in economics. We can only imagine what the price tag will be. So better to structure one's affairs for potential imperfection before actual problems take root and markets move with alarming speed. If the goal of investing is resilient wealth creation, focus first on businesses with scarcity value that have inherent cash generating capacity and buy into them at sound prices. This eliminates 90% of the market. Knowing bad but indeterminate shocks will and can come our way, we keep some money aside in a potential hedge like gold that also embodies scarcity value. At the end of the day, prudence is common sense investing. Common sense investing may not have much sound by the lure, but it is the path to resilient wealth creation. And with that, I'd like to turn it back over to our moderator for Q&A.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for that presentation. Tons of information there that I'm sure our audience most certainly benefited from. And thanks for truly diving in on some of our market valuation that we're seeing today. Jumping over, it does look like we have a question here in our live chat coming from one of our regular viewers here, asking if you have any thoughts on Boston properties and if you could dive into those.
So I can make a brief comment on Boston properties. We are shareholders in Boston properties. This is a position that we initiated in the middle of the crisis last year. I think during the COVID crisis, not only did we see interest rates go to very low levels, but we saw a flock to the virtual economy. And we saw people flocking the cities, which were the hotbed for COVID propagation, to the suburbs. In the midst of that transition to the virtual economy, you can imagine that the stock prices for CBD office properties became quite depressed. Having said that, we're great believers in the long-term role of the city. One of the structural shifts in world economies is the mix shift to services. And services are based on networks of human capitals. And those networks exist in greatest form in cities. I know, at least at First Eagle, we're looking forward to the rollout of the vaccine. We're looking forward to moving back to an in-presence office existence. I think we've learned all to be more flexible with tools like Zoom today. But I think there is no substitute for in-person interaction. So we think there's going to be a continued role for well-located property. And in the case of Boston Properties, as an example of our largest U.S. Office real estate investment, you have a business that, in the crisis, had close to 6% unlevered cap rate. And this is interesting to note that cap rates went up even though the real cost of capital went down. Their property has typically cleared at more like 4 to 5% cap rates historically, and that's indeed where private market transactions have happened. And so we've been willing to plant a seed. But I will mention it's a below average size position. And it sort of loops back to my earlier comments that we try to sort of size according to the inherent cyclicality of businesses to a certain extent. And so we've reflected that in position sizing.
Definitely. Thank you for that. And just on, I guess, my personal curiosity there, you do foresee us moving back kind of into a face-to-face in-office, I guess, world, per se. So where do you see these kind of technology-type companies, such as Zoom, where we are on today, kind of ending up in the future post-pandemic? Will they stay at the level of success that they've seen?
So we are a believer in the structural growth of software. You know, if you look at our portfolio, as value investors, you know, we've had some longstanding investments in software companies that are beneficiaries of the trend to the cloud, you know, higher levels of team interaction via software. You know, we do have a foot in the new economy in our portfolios, but we've remained sensitive to price. And some of the companies, in particular, you referenced Zoom, which we don't own, so I can't comment too specifically. But I can make the broad observation that, you know, we've observed obviously rapid rates of growth in companies like this, but it's very difficult for us to find a line of connection, if you will, between the rate of value creation at a company like Zoom and its current stock price. And in fact, you know, I would sort of make the observation, there's only so much room to do Zoom calls in any given day. You know, it's a space where there is competition in the stack. There are other players that are providing software collaboration tools. And so the fact that you don't have a monopoly and the fact that the valuation is disconnected from the current rate of value creation makes it difficult for us to find a margin of safety and the security like that. And so, you know, we've just elected not to go there.
Definitely. Thanks for that. Looks like we have another question here. And if you can reveal it, what was the last equity investment that you made or a really recent one that you can kind of dive into for us here?
So it's hard for us to obviously reveal, you know, our most recent investments, but I can give you a sense of where we committed capital over the last year, you know, where we saw some opportunities during the COVID situation. You know, not only did we sort of commit capital to some CBD office companies, but we found opportunities in CBD residential real estate. There are certain sectors of the global market that have been traditionally more resilient, such as the brewing industry. I made reference to the brewing industry in my earlier comments on First Eagle's history. The brewing industry has been a pretty attractive industry in a number of emerging markets historically, particularly in hotter climates like Latin America. And we saw the opportunity to deploy some capital into some Latin American brewing companies during the crisis because the physical lockdowns obviously reduced near-term entertainment demand and led to a soft patch in those businesses. But these are ultimately companies that have near-monopolistic market positions that have very steady long-term cash flow generating capacity. And so we saw the ability to build positions in some of these companies. And then there were sort of you know, other more eclectic opportunities that we saw around the world, whether they're in investment holding companies, where the holding company was at a big discount to the sum of the parts. Sometimes the holding company discounts widen in a time of crisis. And so we saw the ability to deploy capital in those areas. And there was even a time, you know, if you look at some of our bigger technology holdings, you know, back in the swoon last year where companies like Google or Facebook, which are amongst our largest technology holdings, were trading at the kind of multiples that LBOs were done at, and we were able to commit capital there. So I'd say there's a range of different businesses. There was no one theme, and I think it just comes back to this notion that we truly are believers in an all-weather portfolio. I think it's perhaps no surprise that we saw some opportunities in the new economy. We saw some opportunities in the mature economy in some of the more cyclical real estate areas. And we saw some opportunities in areas of the market that you'd think of as ballast, such as the brewing industry. It was pretty broad. And in fact, the March period of last year was our most active net investing period since the first quarter of 2009.
Definitely. And it looks like we have another question rolling in here. If you wouldn't mind revisiting the sizing of gold within your portfolio and gold miners, looks like our commenter here thought it was around 17% last year and the size of your currency hedge.
So if you look at the weighting of gold in our portfolio and you combine both the bullion and the miners, it's a mid-teens percentage or so in the portfolio. And I'd say historically it's tended to sort of top out at around those levels. We sort of felt prudently that we don't want to have a directional perspective on gold. It is there as a potential hedge. If it were to be north of a 20% position in our portfolios, we'd be starting to feel we'd be taking a directional perspective. And we have to remain open-minded to the possibility that there are states of the world where the price of gold could go down. So, for example, with all of this fiscal stimulus, if we got a stronger than expected recovery and the Fed turned hawkish, surprisingly, then the dollar could appreciate, real interest rate expectations may move up, and that could be an environment characterized by headwinds for gold. Having said that, for all the reasons we discussed, we're comfortable with the kind of sizing that we have as a potential hedge because, we feel that risk asset valuations are borderline speculative at this point in time. We feel that the financial architecture of the world has meaningful vulnerabilities given the record stock of debt to GDP and the transition to more experimental policy backdrop. There remain many geopolitical unknowns that exist in the world today in terms of the clash of different cultures and regimes. And there are other things that could happen that are outside the realm of expectations. For example, there's been dramatic underinvestment in the energy patch. If we had a stronger than expected recovery into a week of tepid supply for oil markets, we could see the risk of a spike in oil prices. And so there are constellations of events that could occur that we want to maintain some potential hedge against, given that we are primarily owners of enterprise. If you look at our overall portfolio allocation, it's closer to 70 to 75% invested in equities, selectively invested in equities, and just under 10% in cash and other sovereign securities that we would look to deploy were the opportunities to become more favorable at some point.
Understood. Thanks for that. Looks like a next question here that we had roll in. If you wouldn't mind sharing your thoughts on Ambev.
So I guess I made an indirect allusion to Ambev before when I mentioned that we made some investments in Latin American brewers. And, Ambev is representative of one of the investments that we made. This is a company that obviously suffered during the COVID lockdowns and the virus in particular was very harsh in Brazil, where Ambev supports north of 50% market share. And even before COVID struck, Brazil had been going through a very deep recession, which had served as a headwind to entertainment and the like. And so this is a business that if you look back a few years ago before the cyclical slowdown in Brazil, generated materially higher earnings power. And it's very strongly capitalized and was available during the COVID period at a modest multiple of its normalized free cash flow generating capacity.
Definitely. Thanks for that. And in your previous answer to the previous question, going back, you brought up some kind of energy, oil, things like that. With the continued push nowadays kind of on these new EV companies like Tesla, things like that, do you see the market really turning towards that in the future, or do you see that as the future of kind of transportation in our world?
It's a great question. And let me start out by saying that our aggregate position sizing in energy is less than 5% of the portfolio. So like everything, First Eagle wise, our participation is prudently sized. What I would say is that it's clear that there's a shift towards electric vehicles that's going on in the auto fleet. And you have to believe that if you're a shareholder in Tesla, which we're not. Having said that, if you look at the demand for oil, gasoline represents only about 30% of the demand. And the replacement of the auto fleet, even if it went fully electric, is probably a 30-plus year journey. So, we would say that it represents a headwind to demand rather than a shrink in demand. Don't forget that in America, we consume nearly 20 barrels of oil per person per year, and that compares to about 3 barrels per person per year in the BRICS. And they'd like our lifestyle. We already see miles driven higher in China than pre-COVID. So energy transitions tend to be very long. And if you think of some of the companies that we have investments in, they're not just oil-centric, but they have large natural gas businesses. If you buy an electric vehicle, you have to plug it into the grid at night. And the majority of incremental power to the electricity grid is coming from natural gas at this point in time. And so these businesses have fade risk. I think every business, to some extent, is going to be a melting ice cube at some point. But we think that the fade is perhaps a little less quick than perhaps what the markets sense. And there are elements of energy demand that continue to grow, whether it's jet aviation fuel once we get through COVID or some of the specialty lubricants or higher end plastics, which is substituting for materials. Think of what goes into your iPhone, for example. One has to weigh price and prospects. Some of these companies got to pretty cheap valuations. They were single-digit multiples of cash flow on depressed earnings. One has to disentangle price from prospects and the cyclical normalization opportunities as well. And so we balance all of these factors and putting it all together, we have a sort of a modest position, but we found some opportunities there.
Definitely. Thanks for that. It looks like we have another question coming in here, specifically referring to Bruce and Tano as primarily teaching us a bottom-up fundamental analysis with a little time spent on risk mitigation. Question asking, as a portfolio manager, would you mind sharing how you make decisions specifically on weighting positions? Kind of what does that thought process look like?
It's a great question, and Bruce and Tano have really contributed to the intellectual vibrancy of our team. Bruce has been particularly focused on the art of business categorization and the notion that growth is only valuable if it's profitable and near monopolistic, and you should only pay for advantage growth. And I think Bruce has taught us a lot about how to think about the value of growth. And measured growth over long periods of time. I think Tano is focused equally on such measures, but I think Tano has a history in monetary economics and studying risk premia. So, Tano brings perspective on the price of risk in general. And I think Tano is exploring in his work position sizing, which I think is kind of one of the next frontiers for investing. And it's a topic that we spent a lot of time thinking about at First Eagle. And even though we're selective participants in markets, we are diversified by nature. Being global, we can be both diversified and selective. We have over 100 positions in our portfolio. So our position sizes tend to be small to begin with. We tend to plant small initial sizes, 25, 35 basis points. And we gradually grow those seeds as we get fundamental confirmation and if price is still appealing. I think one of the things perhaps we do a little differently from what you might think of as traditional value investors is we don't just reflexively add on price weakness. Sometimes if there's fundamental disappointment relative to your initial underwriting expectations, you need to be humble enough to respect that and not sort of be blindly contrarian, if you will. I alluded to the fact before that we tend to be sensitive to the nature of a business and position sizing. We own a number of companies that are prime competitors in more competitive industries, those industries can become more correlated in a downside economic shock. And so we tend to have a minority of our portfolio in such businesses and a majority in some of the businesses that have more entrenched market position and a degree more pricing power through the cycle. So those are all sorts of things that we think about. And then we're mindful of aggregate industry exposures. And I think you got a sense for that in my comments. And we're mindful for the role of ballast in the portfolio. So all of these things come into the discussion of position sizing. And I think it's an area where, we would look to hopefully distinguish ourselves in the marketplace.
Definitely. And as we're running up against our time limit here, we'll kind of round out on our final question. Now that we've, very deeply kind of looked at buying and sizing positions, with such a long-term investment horizon, when do y'all actually end up selling a position, if you ever do entirely?
It depends on the nature of a business. And there's the easy decisions. If the stock has gone up, if the business is a prime competitor, that owns hard real assets that are advantaged, if the business starts to create a premium to the runoff value of the cash flows attendant to those assets, and there's not a lot of scope for reinvestment and growth in that business, we'll tend to sell out of prudence because we've lost the margin of safety. On the other hand, if the business is more of a franchise compounder, it's a more nuanced decision. The business may get to a more full and fair valuation, but if it's still compounding an intrinsic value, time is working in our favor, and so we might be more patient sellers of a situation like that. And then there's the harsh reality trips that I kind of alluded to before and the importance of not being blindly contrarian. When you own over 100 investments, statistically, you're going to get some wrong. No one has a perfect crystal ball. And there are disruptive trends that play out in industries. Sometimes managements do stupid things and impair the balance sheets. And you've got to recognize sometimes it's important to take a loss. If the nature of the business has changed or management's character has injected an element of risk into the equation.
Definitely. And thanks for that. That today looks like is going to round out all of our questions and the time we have. For those of you out in the audience, if you missed any part of the presentation, you want to look back on things, look back at those slides, anything like that, there will be a full recording of this posted here just a moment here on our YouTube as well as on Guru Focus. And without anything else from me, I'd like to thank you, Matt, for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure. It was a wonderful presentation, and thanks for taking the time to dive into these questions with our audience.
I enjoyed the discussion. Thanks very much for having us on. Don't forget, prudence can be exciting long term.
Definitely. And for everybody out there, and yourself included, Matt, we hope everybody out there stays safe and stays healthy moving into the future. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.